Questions of Faith, Lecture 13. What would Socrates think?
Socrates, Jesus, and Buddha were probably the three most influential individuals who ever lived. They were like new suns casting new lights on things under our sun. Buddha appealed to our inner light, and Jesus claimed to be the light from heaven. And Socrates focused the light of logic on every idea, including religious ideas. And not many ideas survived his cross-examination. What if he had met Buddha and Jesus? Would they survive? Socrates was a religious man, in fact, a martyr, executed for his religious convictions. But he was an agnostic. An agnostic is one who does not claim to know, especially about God. He wonders. He would like to know. That's the whole point of questioning. But he doesn't know. That's the point of the joke about the dyslexic, insomniac agnostic who stayed up all night wondering, is there a dog? Yet this agnostic, executed for impiety because he could not honestly say he believed in the gods of Athens, was really the most pious man in Athens. He was also the humblest. He was something like Camus' saint without God. But he was no atheist. He heard and obeyed a so-called divine voice that spoke to him from within, and also whatever divine voice inspired the Delphic Oracle, when this voice told his friend Chaerephon that no one in the world was wiser than Socrates. Socrates took this message from the oracle so seriously that he devoted the rest of his life to trying to find someone wiser than himself. And in doing so, he developed the art of logical cross-examination, the Socratic method. Wouldn't it be fascinating to overhear a conversation among Socrates, Buddha, and Jesus? Well, we can. We have an inner theater called the imagination, and an inner playwright called creativity. And we have some very good data for all three sages in the form of texts written by their disciples. Since the philosophy of religion means philosophy looking at religion, and since Socrates is the archetypal philosopher, and since Jesus and Buddha are two archetypal religious figures, let's try to imagine what Socrates would say if confronted with Jesus and Buddha, or rather with the teachings of them, since it's difficult to know the more mysterious question of how their personalities might interact. Both Buddha and Jesus say apparently illogical things, and even their disciples found their teachings difficult to believe. Buddha at one point had only 5 disciples when he first achieved the great enlightenment under the Bo tree, and all Jesus' disciples left him at the crucial point when he was being crucified, except the women and one man, John. So it is not likely that Socrates would have been one of the faithful few disciples to either of these two teachers. Socrates was more, not less, skeptical than ordinary people. So he would certainly have a very difficult time believing either that all ordinary consciousness is dream and illusion, or that this man is God. But he would be intrigued enough to question these two strange men relentlessly. Let's try to imagine how the questioning might go. Take Buddha first. Socrates always lets the other speak first, then questions him, first as to the meaning of what he says, then as to the truth of it. So he would probably let Buddha speak first, and Buddha would have no trouble at all summarizing all his teaching very briefly. He has only 4 things to say, the 4 noble truths. The 4 noble truths are to practice what Socrates' logic is to theory. Just as a syllogism is the model for all deductive argument, the ideal form of all theoretical thinking, no matter what the content, so the 4 noble truths are the ideal form of all practical thinking, no matter what the content. They ask the 4 questions a doctor asks: the symptoms, the diagnosis, the prognosis, and the prescription. What are the effects of a disease? What is the cause of these effects? What is the healing that can come if the cause is removed? And what must be done to bring about this healing? So the bad effect, the bad cause, the good effect, and the good cause. These are the only 4 practical questions we can ever ask about anything. Now, everything works by the principle of causality. Buddha knew that as well as Socrates. Socrates applied it to the objective science of the mind. All of Western science is indebted to Socrates, who was the first person in human history who knew clearly what a logical argument was, when a point was logically proved, that is, explained by its causes. Buddha knew that principle too, but he applied it to the inner science of the self. His first noble truth is a datum from experience, the commonest experience in the world, verifiable by anyone, the truth of suffering, dukkha. To live is to suffer. All of life is infected by suffering. Nothing is perfect. There are really two points here in the first noble truth. First, that everyone seeks perfect happiness, and second, that no one finds it. Because if they did, they'd stop seeking. And if they didn't seek it, if they didn't want it, then not finding what they didn't want wouldn't be suffering. So here's the first noble truth, that every life is filled with suffering, or dukkha, which is a gap between what we are and what we want to be, or between what we have and what we want to have. The original meaning of the word dukkha as the gap between these two parts of a broken bone or a broken axle is then applied to the broken soul. Buddha is very specific in enumerating the areas of suffering. To be separated from what you want, or to be present to what you don't want, is suffering. There is suffering in being born and in dying, in growth and in diminishment. No part of life is free from it. Of course, Socrates knew this problem and had his own unique solution to it. He thought happiness depended on virtue, and virtue in turn depended on wisdom, the knowledge of the true good. All unhappiness came from evil, and all evil came from ignorance, according to Socrates. So if we only knew, without doubt, that virtue always led to happiness, then we would always be virtuous, because we always want happiness. So for Socrates, the key to virtue and thus to happiness lay in knowledge, a kind of knowledge unhappy people do not have. So Socrates tried to lead them to it, out of the cave of their ignorance and into the light of knowledge. Not just a knowledge of facts, but a knowledge of the good, a knowledge that was wisdom. To achieve this wisdom would require a long, hard process of struggle against habits of ignorance and laziness and conformity to ordinary opinions. It would be like struggling up a steep, rocky road out of a comfortable cave of shadows into a strange new world outside. At the end of the struggle, there would be a sudden, surprising, shocking emergence into light, a different kind of light. The liberated prisoner would stand blinking in the sun, unable to categorize this light or put it into words. Then he would go back down into the cave and try to liberate his poor fellow prisoners, who were ignorant not only of this true light, but even ignorant of their own ignorance. He would try to persuade them of this, first of all, the knowledge of their ignorance, intellectual humility, wisdom's lesson one. And this lesson would be so threatening and insulting to them that they would call him insane and kill them. The message of this philosopher would be threatening for two reasons, the insult and the compliment. The insult is that we are far stupider than we think. We confuse shadows of reality with reality, and we use these shadows as the standard to judge everything else. So we reject the philosopher's invitation to climb outside the cave into the light. But we are also far wiser than we think, for we all have within us the knowledge of that light, unconsciously. Socrates didn't think we had an innate factual knowledge, for instance, that there is an animal like a dog, but more like the knowledge that there is something like a God, the knowledge that's only waiting to be liberated into the conscious mind from the unconscious. It's tied up in us. We're not born free. We're born into the slavery of ignorance, born into the cave. The knowledge of the world outside the cave is like the prisoner in us, tied up in the cave of our own ignorance, but ready to be liberated into the sunlit world of our consciousness. That's why Socrates used the method of questioning. The presupposition of a question is that the one being questioned has the knowledge of the answer in his mind already, somewhere. He only needs help to get it out, but not to get it in. Socrates called himself a midwife. He helps us to get our own baby of wisdom out of the womb of our mind. He is not the father of that baby. He is only our intellectual obstetrician. And his questions are the forceps that he uses to get the baby out. So Socrates already understands Buddha in these two ways, our innate ignorance and our innate wisdom. Now, Socrates' road out of the cave is much more rational, and Buddha's is much more mystical, but both thinkers share these two assumptions, the great insult and the great compliment, our innate foolishness and our innate wisdom. But when Buddha goes on to his second noble truth, I think Socrates would probably not agree. Socrates says the origin of all unhappiness is lack of moral virtue and intellectual wisdom. Buddha says it is desire. The cause of suffering is desire. The cause of dukkha is tanha, greed, grasping. Even innocent and natural desires fall under tanha, like the desire to continue to live or the desire to increase your knowledge. Buddha says that all desires that come from the self, even if they don't harm anyone else, harm you. They are the cause of your suffering. Why? Because the very essence of suffering, or unhappiness, is the gap between desire and satisfaction, between what you want and what you have. Now that gap is not created by reality, but by desire. The gap between the two cheap cars you have and the four expensive cars you want is not caused by the cars, but by your wanting them. If you didn't want more than you had, you'd be satisfied. Except that even then you'd want to keep what you have, and you'd fear losing it, and thus you'd still be unhappy. Any selfish desire, any desire that comes from the self, any desire that has the word I before it, creates that gap between itself and reality, which defines your unhappiness, which is your unhappiness. That's Buddha's analysis. And Buddha would try to explain to Socrates, very rationally, that if unhappiness is the gap between desire and satisfaction, then the only two possible roads to happiness would be the increase of satisfactions or the decrease of desires. And everyone in the world has been walking the path of trying to increase satisfactions without anyone ever succeeding. The whole world agrees with Mick Jagger, "I can't get no satisfaction." Or, "You can't always get what you want." So isn't it reasonable to try the path of decreasing desire? And by that, Buddha means not asceticism. That's another set of desires. He teaches instead his middle way of neither gratifying desires nor attacking them. Both pays too much attention to desire. He says to ignore them. Just let them die. Let the fuel run out so that the fire will cease. The fuel is desire. The fire is suffering. Now, once you admit Buddha's second noble truth, the other two follow fairly easily. Once you know the disease that causes the symptoms, you can treat the disease instead of just the symptoms. The thing you need the doctor for, above all, is the second noble truth, the diagnosis. You already know the first truth if you're the patient. You know your own symptoms. But you don't know what's causing them. Once you do, once the disease is diagnosed, then the prognosis and the prescription follow fairly easily. They're usually standard. You can find them in medical books. So the only one of the four steps you can't do for yourself is the diagnosis. I think Socrates would probably disagree with Buddha's diagnosis. He would agree that selfish desire makes us ignorant and unhappy, but he would not see that as the only cause of unhappiness. For Socrates, there are four vices, not just one, that make us unhappy. A lack of wisdom in the mind, a lack of courage in the spirited part, a lack of moderation and self-control in relating the appetites to the reason, and a lack of justice as the harmony of all the soul's powers, each doing its own proper work, and a harmony of interpersonal relations. So Socrates wouldn't see desire as such, all desire, as the problem, only unwise and immoderate desires, desires unregulated by reason. He would see Buddha's diagnosis as too simple, too radical, and thus his prescription also as too simple and too radical, a kind of euthanasia for the soul, killing the patient to cure the disease, killing the ego to cure egotism. Buddha would reply that it's not killing the ego, it's seeing through the ego as an illusion. The most shocking thing in all of Buddha's teaching is probably the idea that there is no such thing as an ego or self in the first place. At this point in the conversation, things might get even more difficult. For Western thought, whether religious or secular, the ego is real and is the cause of egotism. And if the product is bad, the solution is to take it back to the factory and fix it, change it, from egotism to altruism. But you need the same cause, the same factory, the same ego, to produce either the bad product or the good one, either egotism or altruism, either injustice or justice. You need a self as the cause to produce either selfish greed or justice and love as its products. That's not Buddha's analysis. He says the opposite. The ego is not real and therefore not a real cause. For Buddha, it's egotism that produces the illusion of the ego rather than a real ego that produces egotism. Well, then, what produces egotism? Socrates would ask Buddha. And he would reply that it is the strands or skandhas of consciousness that are like the strands of a rope. They bunch together at birth, producing the illusion of a single substantial self, and then they come unknotted again at death. They're something like the Gulf Stream, strands of water, or like winds that come together for a while and seem to get an identity. We name our hurricanes with proper names. Buddha would say that the persons that we name with proper names are no more substantial or lasting than those storms. They're like the filaments of star stuff that coalesce into stars, and then the star eventually dissipates most of its matter and energy back into the void, perhaps ending as an exploding supernova. The separate identity of the star is only temporary and really illusory. So Buddha's answer to Socrates' great puzzle, know thyself, is that there is no self. Know thyself is a koan, an unsolvable puzzle. To know the self is to know that there is no self to know. Socrates would probably find this not only paradoxical, but unthinkable. Who is it that knows that there is no one there doing the knowing? He would ask. And Buddha would probably reply that the whole purpose of such a paradox is not to be solved, but to change your consciousness. You don't conquer it. You don't defeat it. You don't answer it. It defeats you. Buddha's third noble truth, the truth of nirvana, the extinction of suffering through the extinction of desire, follows with inexorable logic. Premise one, the problem is suffering. Premise two, the cause of suffering is desire. Premise three, the principle of causality, to remove the effect, remove the cause. Conclusion, nirvana, or extinction of all suffering through extinction of all desire. That's Buddha's gospel, Buddha's good news, the prognosis of salvation from suffering, a total cure, a way out of the cave of suffering, and of ignorance. Suffering and ignorance are cured together, just as Socrates thought. It's a triple package deal for Buddha and for Socrates. Ignorance, vice, and suffering are one package, and enlightenment, virtue, and happiness are the other package. And the glue that holds both packages together is total. There's no way either package can be split up so that anyone can take one part without the other two, or two parts without the third. Where the two thinkers differ is on what causes what. Does selfish desire cause ignorance, or does ignorance cause selfish desire? The fourth noble truth, the prescription, is Buddha's noble eightfold path. The path is the practice of virtue and the overcoming of selfishness, a process of egotism reduction. The fire of suffering is extinguished by extinguishing all its fuel, piece by piece. I think Socrates would not disagree with Buddha's principle of causality or with this triple package deal, but I think he would not agree that egotism can exist without an ego or cause the illusion of the ego or that the ego could be an illusion. And second, he would not agree that selfish desire is the cause of ignorance of our true identity. He would say ignorance of our true identity is the cause of selfish desire. And finally, Socrates' prescription for wisdom is to live according to reason. That is not Buddha's prescription. Reason generates concepts. Concepts are what Socrates is always trying to define. Concepts go together with desires. Both reason and desire have finite objects that are definable. Buddha wants us to transcend both into infinity. I think infinity would not appeal to Socrates at all. So how would Buddha deal with Socrates' objections? Not by argument, because all arguments need concepts, and concepts need definitions, and definitions are finite. But Buddha is trying to persuade us to abandon the finite, to abandon all desire and all concepts. Now, how would he persuade Socrates to do that? By reasoning? But how could Socrates see enough reason for him to abandon his reason, to leave the shore of finite concepts and sail out into Buddha's infinite sea? Reasoning with Socrates to persuade him to abandon reasoning would be self-defeating, for it would presuppose reason, even in reasoning against reason. So I think the two of them would probably be left at a standstill, or like ships passing in the night, despite all the profound things they had in common. These things were not just platitudes, but surprising wisdoms. Socrates would probably declare himself agnostic about Buddha's claims about nirvana, and Buddha would probably not try to force Socrates, but just let his time and his karma come. I will not even try to imagine how a conversation between Jesus and Buddha would go, but I think we can imagine one between Socrates and Jesus. As with the conversation with Buddha, it would focus on his most outrageous claim, and for Jesus, that would surely be the claim to be divine, to be not just a God, but the God, the one God who created the universe, or the son of this God, and equal to him, as a son is equal to a father in nature, in species. I don't think Socrates would try to figure out the Christian doctrine of the Trinity, not because that idea is too mysterious, but because Jesus never explicitly taught it. The Trinity is the Christian Church's doctrine from a later century. The doctrine of the Trinity is, in a way, like a complex hypothesis in physics that tries to account for and reconcile all the apparently conflicting data, such as the absoluteness of the speed of light and the relativity of all measurements, or the fact that light behaves like waves and like particles. The Trinity is a theological explanation or hypothesis that the Church came up with after centuries of disputes to explain and reconcile all the data in the New Testament, basically these four things: that there's only one God, that the being Jesus calls his Father is God, that Jesus is God, God the Son, and that the Holy Spirit is God. But though Jesus didn't teach the doctrine of the Trinity, he did claim to be divine. And this is what Socrates would naturally find very difficult to believe. He would first try to understand what the idea meant before looking at any reasons there might be for believing it, because if the idea contained a self-contradiction, then it must be false, no matter what else may be true. And it certainly seems to be self-contradictory, rather like claiming that a man is a fish. In fact, a man is closer to a fish than to God, for any two finite things are closer to each other than either one is to infinity. The God Jesus spoke of was not one of the imperfect, finite gods of paganism, but the one perfect, eternal, immortal, all-wise, all-powerful, invisible, creator God of Judaism. But man is an imperfect, temporal, mortal, ignorant, weak, and visible creature. So this seems like an obviously self-contradictory concept. The only possible reply, logically, would be to distinguish contraries from contradictories. Contraries are two opposite concepts, or natures, or essences, or forms, or qualities, like hot and cold, or black and white, or good and bad, or love and hate. Concepts are expressed in terms, not propositions. Contradictories, on the other hand, are two propositions that can't possibly both be true at the same time, like the sky is black and the sky is not black, or she loves me and she loves me not. If there's no ambiguity in the terms, if the love in she loves me means the same thing as the love in she loves me not, then she loves me and she loves me not are contradictory propositions. But since love and hate are only contrary concepts, she loves me and she hates me are not contradictory propositions. Concepts that are opposite to each other, like love and hate, or even exclusive of each other, like visible and invisible, could be predicated of different aspects of the same entity, such as a human being. My body is visible. My mind, my thinking, and my character are invisible. So the claim that one person is both human and divine at the same time is not a self-contradictory concept by its logical form alone. If it were, it would not only be false, but literally unthinkable. No one could believe it. There would be no intelligible content there to believe. But though psychologically believable, the idea still seems logically unworthy of belief. I think Socrates would insist on spending a lot of time defining it very clearly before arguing for or against it. That's what he did with nearly everything. Now, to define anything has two steps. First, put it in a general class, a genus, then distinguish it from other things in that genus. So a genus categorizes it. So what category would Socrates use for defining Jesus? Socrates might have learned from Buddha about the Hindu category of avatars. An avatar is an appearance on earth in human form of the Supreme God for the purpose of communicating his wisdom to man. Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita is an avatar, or an appearance of Brahman, come to teach the warrior Arjuna the way of karma yoga, the yoga of daily work, so that Arjuna can attain the supreme goal of self-realization in his daily work, simply by purifying his motive for the work from egotistic greed for gain to religious duty, not hankering after the fruits. This same book, the Bhagavad Gita, also teaches another yoga, Bhakti Yoga, the religion of personal love and faith and devotion to an avatar like Krishna, since most of us find it hard to direct our spiritual energies to an infinite and formless God and need a human person to focus this devotion. For a man to teach a dog, he has to act like a dog. So for God to teach man, God has to appear as a man, and that's an avatar. But classifying Jesus as an avatar won't work for two reasons. First, the claim for Jesus, implicit in his own words and explicit in the claims Paul and later Christians make for him, is that he is not one among many, an individual example of a general category, but that he is the only incarnation of God, the only Son of God. And second, avatars are mere appearances, like reflections of the sun in puddles. They're divine, but they're not really human. Now, it's certainly a question whether Jesus is divine. In the Gospels, many doubt his divinity, but no one doubts his humanity. Well, another possible category might be that of guru, enlightened master, awakened one, like Buddha. But Buddha forbade anyone to divinize him, while Jesus did not. And Buddhist gurus don't speak of God or Brahman or even of Atman, the deep soul, but Hindu gurus do. So why couldn't Socrates define Jesus as a Hindu guru? Gurus claim they're divine. Tattvam asi, thou art that. You are Brahman in your deepest identity as Atman. So might Jesus be an enlightened guru? Well, the problem there is Jesus' exclusivism. All the gurus are inclusivists. They call other avatars divine, too. In fact, they call all of us divine, for all of us are Atman, and Atman is Brahman. If Jesus had taught that, we would have a set of categories for him. But there is no evidence that Jesus taught that, and massive evidence that he did not. He taught not that we are all God, but that we are all sinners, alienated from God, covenant breakers, divorcees, in need of reconciliation, or at-one-ment, atonement. I don't think Socrates would be able to either agree or disagree with these religious ideas, because he wouldn't define them yet. And when he did define them, I think he would see clear and sharp differences between Jesus and all the gurus. If Jesus was trying to teach the message of the gurus, if we can categorize Jesus as a guru, then we have to categorize him as the worst guru in history, because he contradicted the teachings of the gurus on almost every important issue. And the reason for this is very simple. Jesus was a Jew. What the Jews meant by God was strikingly different than what all the gurus meant. First of all, God in their language was a person. His self-revealed name was I Am. The human I was the image of God, not the supreme illusion. In the second place, God was transcendent to the universe and created it out of nothing. And third, God had a will and gave moral commandments. Morality goes all the way up for a Jew, but not for a Hindu. It's a necessary preliminary to the mystical consciousness that's beyond good and evil to a Hindu, but it doesn't go all the way up. And fourth, Jesus taught by means of miracles and prophecies and public scriptures rather than by esoteric private mystical experience like the gurus. And fifth, Jesus absolutely forbade and did not tolerate polytheism and idolatry. And sixth, Jesus did not teach us that everything was one. He discriminated between truth and falsehood, between good and evil, even between heaven and hell. Now, the Eastern gurus teach the opposite of all these things. all these categories are not only absent from the teachings of the gurus, they're absent from Buddhist teaching too, because all categories are, but they're opposed to the categories of the gurus. You couldn't imagine Buddha or the Hindu gurus agreeing with any of these six ideas. So Socrates might try a third category, perhaps at Buddha's suggestion. The category of a tulku in Tibetan Buddhism is somewhere between the category of an avatar and a guru. A tulku is like a radiator of divine energies. But this category would probably share the defects of both the avatar and the guru without avoiding any of them. Still another category for Jesus might be that of a prophet, a messenger or mouthpiece of God. This is much more likely historically. It's a Jewish category, and Jesus was a Jew. But none of the prophets are divine. God's prophets are not God. Muhammad accepts Jesus' claim to be a prophet. The Quran even says Jesus was virgin-born, performed miracles, raised the dead, and will come at the end of the world to judge the world. Muslims often ask why Christians don't accept their claim that Muhammad was a prophet, since they accept Christians' claims that Jesus was one. But the claim for Jesus goes beyond that of a prophet. Jesus himself called himself more than a prophet. I think Socrates would practice the art of listening well enough to avoid the comfortable compromise of changing the meaning of the fundamental claim of any religion before he argued about it, even though that would give him an alternative to rejecting the claim outright. But rejection seems to be what Socrates would have to do, as he did with Buddha. Even the Christian philosopher Kierkegaard calls the idea that this man Jesus is God the absolute paradox. I won't speculate what Jesus would say back to Socrates, but some Christians would argue this way. Socrates, how could you claim to know so much about God that you know in advance that God would never become man, or could never become man? Your intellectual humility and agnosticism should allow for that possibility, shouldn't it? Isn't it less humble, less agnostic, to claim to know that it's impossible than to think it might be possible? Isn't the onus of proof on the unbeliever? I think Socrates would probably consider that a weak argument, one that could be used to justify believing almost any idea, however wild and wacky. What's the positive evidence for the idea? The simplest and most obvious answer comes from the earliest sources, the four Gospels. It wasn't mainly the miracles, but the character and personality of Jesus that was so convincing. And here Jesus and Buddha suddenly come together, rather surprisingly. They were different from everybody else. From everyone they met, they provoked the question, "What are you?" Not just, "Who are you?" Are you a man or more than a man? They gave different answers. Buddha said he was only a man who woke up, and Jesus said he was more. But both answers were hard to believe. Some later Buddhists, the Pure Land sect, said Buddha must be a god, not just a man, and they worshipped him as the savior, the other power, who would take them to the pure land of heaven after death. And some later Christians, the modernists, found Jesus' claim to be divine unbelievable and said he was simply the ideal man. Strange convergence of opposites. Now, who would believe Buddha's teaching that we're all sleeping, that not one of our ideas is worth more than a dream? Well, Socrates might, for he begins with nearly as radical an insult that we're all prisoners in a cave, mistaking shadows for reality. Who would believe that the only happiness comes from not striving for happiness? Socrates might, and the later Stoics did. And who would practice this difficult way of Buddha's, the Noble Eightfold Path? Who would give up everything for nothing? Nobody, if I taught it. But when Buddha taught it, he became the greatest teacher in the East, for he was holy to his fingertips. The same psychological principle must account for Jesus getting disciples, any disciples at all. If I said what Jesus said, you would lock me up as a madman. I am God. I am your Savior. Worship me and trust your soul to me. I have all authority in heaven and on earth. I alone can forgive your sins. I will come to judge the whole world. Who in his right mind would believe that and give up everything for it and suffer martyrdom for it? No one, if I taught it. So if Socrates never met Jesus, I don't see any chance he would ever believe the idea any more than the Buddhist idea. He was so agnostic that he found it difficult enough to believe even ordinary ideas. How much more these two extraordinary ideas? But if he did meet these two people, or even disciples of them who had caught enough of their spirit, what would he think then? If he thought the thing through at all, he would certainly do this logically, and he'd probably use the same logical structure of argument on both men, and I think it would be something like this. Either they tell the truth or not. If not, there are only two reasons why anyone does not tell the truth. Either he knows what he says is not the truth, or he does not. If he knows it's not true, he's a deceiver. If he does not know that it's not true, he's deceived. So he's either a truth teller or a deceiver or deceived. Now, what would it take to be a teller of such a deception? How big a lie is this? The gap between the truth and the lie is the measure of how big a lie it is. In both cases, we have such an enormous gap that if these are lies, they're two of the biggest lies ever told. And what would it take to be deceived by such a lie? How big a deception is that? The gap between the truth and the deception is the measure of how big a deception it is. And in both cases, there's such an enormous gap, we'd have to call it insanity. Buddha says not just that some standard ideas are false, but all of them. Jesus says he's not just a prophet, but God. If he believes that and it isn't true, he's more insane than I am if I believe I'm a hamburger or the Archangel Gabriel. But both personalities make such hypotheses very unlikely. We've never seen a liar as moral and trustable as these two, or a lunatic as wise and creative. Both men have an amazing amount of all three virtues that neither liars nor lunatics have: wisdom, compassion, and creativity. Practical wisdom to solve other people's deepest problems and enlighten their lives, and compassion to the extent that their whole identity was their identification with others, especially the poor and suffering, and creativity that made them interesting to friend and enemy alike. They are not boring and predictable and inflexible and repetitive, just the opposite. Liars or lunatics may be clever enough to camouflage wisdom or even compassion for a while, but they can't imitate that creativity. So, all three hypotheses seem equally unlikely: truth, lie, or lunacy. Yet these are the only three logically possible hypotheses. So what would Socrates do? What answer would he give? I think he would do exactly what you have done in buying this course. He would listen. And he would think and wonder and ponder and question and go over the data again and again from as many different angles as possible. As to what answer he would finally give, I think he was too honest to either ignore the question or to give a quick, comfortable answer. He was a fanatic about the truth. Truth trumped everything for him. But that didn't mean that finding the truth was the very first thing looking for it was. That took serious time and serious listening. We've been preaching that listening more than practicing it in these lectures, and we have only one chance left to do it, so we'll try to do it in our next lecture.
This ends Lecture 13. Questions of Faith, Lecture 14, Religious Experience.
At the beginning of these lectures, we raised the problem of method. Should the philosopher of religion approach religion from without or from within? We said that both are necessary, but we've used mainly the critical method from without, but not much of the empathetic, experiential method. So in this lecture, we'll try to worm our way into the inside of the religious experience by some imagination and empathy. We'll try to understand something of the essential religious experience of each of the world's major religions: Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, Confucianism, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Not the abstract common essence of religious experience, that's at least as hard to define as religion itself, but different religious experiences unique to each religion. We begin with Hinduism, probably the world's oldest religion. It has many varieties, but the goal of all of them is the experience of what we might call the beyond within. The West has focused most of its attention on conquering the world without by science and technology, but India has explored the seas and continents of the self with as much interest as we've directed towards the seas and continents without, a kind of spiritual technology, an inner athleticism, seeking a science of the self, a map of inner space, which is even vaster than outer space, and spiritual technologies for changing our consciousness and desires rather than changing the objects in the world, to create a heaven in the soul rather than a heaven on earth. These spiritual technologies are called yogas, and the one most natural to the philosopher is Jnana Yoga, the yoga of thought. Imagine you're in a dentist's chair having some painful root canal work. The pain is not only physical, but also mental. Corpses feel no pain. If you could somehow overcome self-consciousness, you could overcome the primary dimension of pain, the mental. You'd be out of your body watching it experience pain. You'd speak about yourself in the third person. How interesting. Professor Kraft is experiencing great pain in tooth number 20. Well, in Jnana Yoga, you do that all the time. Or imagine you're giving a talk to 1,000 people who are scrutinizing you suspiciously, and you're looking at these people with your emotion of fear. Imagine you could be out of your emotions, looking at these emotions unemotionally, contemplatively. How interesting. There's Professor Kraft making a fool of himself behind the microphone. You just observe it. You don't identify with it or love it or hate it. You just see it. Now, that it is your daily self. It is no longer you. It is the object of your awareness. You are nothing but this act of awareness. The objects of awareness are always many, but the subject is always one. What is that subject? It's not any one of the objects. It's not a what at all. It's indefinable. It's not different from anything else, because if it were, it would be definable. It's like an infinite mirror that reflects all finite things. It's not square or round or red or blue or big or small. It's nothing and everything. Nothing because it's no one thing, like a small red ball rather than a large blue sky, but also everything because it becomes whatever is given to it. It's the one thinker of every thought. And thou art that, tat tvam asi. That's the supreme discovery of Hinduism. Now, this little imaginative trip was not Jnana Yoga. It was talking about Jnana Yoga. It was verbal and conceptual. It's a lecture, after all. Yoga is not a lecture on yoga. I hope you followed the words and the concepts that they expressed, but that was only a roadmap. If you actually took this trip within, if you followed your actual thought energy and arrived at that empty mirror, that non-objectifiable subject, that unknown knower, by your own direct experience, if you sat alone, totally undistracted, and meditated and discovered this still point of the turning world, that would be the Hindu religious experience. It would be a religious experience, not just a psychological one, because this mirror is not yours or mine or anyone else's. It's absolute, and absolutely one, and infinite and timeless. It's Atman, the deep self that's really Brahman, the supreme one. You have discovered God, the God who is neither the finite ego you call yourself nor any possible finite object of that ego. You can't express this experience in words because words are made for ordinary experience of finite things, the experience of duality, yourself standing over against your other. But Brahman is not yourself or your other. Brahman is not yours. This is not ordinary experience. It is religious experience. What does it feel like? Well, it's not usually emotional, but you find you have infinite mental energy. Not energy to do anything, just to be there. You're all silent inside. You stop breathing. You're literally all attention. And there's no object of attention, there's just attention. You're totally awake and alert and alive and aware, but there's no intellectual calculation or definition or even movement of meditation. You may have gotten to this state by meditation, but now that mental movement has stopped. There's nothing to do and no desire to do it. But there's no boredom either, because there's no time or no consciousness of time. There's just perfect peace. This is the mind of God. And once you have been there, you can never forget it. It's your home. And when you travel away from this home, you feel exiled, and you have to go back again and again and meditate until you find that place of peace again. Until you are that peace again. In that peace, you are also freed from greed and lust and fear about anything in the world, because you know that nothing else can ever rival this, and you know that nothing else ultimately matters, because nothing else is ultimate, and this is. The Hindu religious experience I've described is not only Hindu. It's found among Jews, Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, even agnostics. Rabbi Martin Buber experienced it and compared it with his Jewish religious experience as a precious preliminary. He saw this infinite mirror, this Atman, as absolute compared to the world, but still relative compared to God. Buber saw God as a kind of mirror of all these human mirrors, so that there was still an I-thou relationship to God and to other human mirrors, but not the ordinary relationship to finite objects. The experience is interpreted differently in different religions, but the experience itself is universal. It doesn't come from Hinduism, it comes from human nature. Hindus are just its oldest map makers. When we turn from Hinduism to Buddhism, we find that Buddhism is like an arrow aimed at a single target, nirvana. And that target seems to be the same experience as in Hinduism, but the arrow, the means to the end, is much simpler. Hindus' means are very complex. Buddhism is a boiled-down, distilled essence, do-it-yourself, purely practical, bottom-line road to the Hindu transformation of consciousness. Even the name for it is simple. Buddha literally means the man who woke up. It's a helpful analogy. Nirvana is like the experience we've all had every day in the morning when we woke up to the real world, to the whole world, not from one part of the world to another part. Nirvana is to what we call waking consciousness, as waking consciousness is to a dream. From the viewpoint of nirvana, ordinary waking consciousness is a dream. The essential Buddhist experience is the total peace and fearlessness that comes when the fire of desire goes out, and when the dream stops, and when you see yourself and all other things as mere images projected on a movie screen. The experience is like a little child in a movie theater for the first time. At first, she's terrified of the man-eating tigers and guns and bullets and blood that she sees on the screen because she thinks they are real. Then, suddenly, she realizes that they're not real. They're only images projected onto the screen. The screen is consciousness. Those tigers can't hurt her because they're not real, and neither is she. They're both only images, dreams. This experience sounds like the opposite of the Hindu one, where the Hindu discovers that he's infinitely more than he thought he was, the Buddhist discovers that he's infinitely less. But those who have actually arrived, both Hindu and Buddhist, usually say that it's the same experience in two different language systems. If you begin in Egypt and go either east or west for 12,000 miles, you come to Hawaii. Total addition and total subtraction lead to the same result. Confucianism is as worldly as Buddhism is unworldly. Though Confucius's ultimate sanction is the will of heaven, Confucianism is agnostic about heaven and about the afterlife and about the gods. It's a religion of this world, full of detailed social and family roles and duties and moral virtues. It's a kind of elaborate dance or a musical fugue. Its central experience is one of harmony, whereas the central experience of Buddhism is like silence. If religions are to be judged by the peace and longevity they produce in society, then Confucianism is certainly the world's most successful religion. Confucius lived during a time of bloody civil war called the Period of Warring States, and his teachings succeeded in holding together the world's largest nation in relative peace and harmony for most of 2,000 years. Until the world's greatest mass murderer, Mao Zedong, conquered it by force and violent revolution and a philosophy based on class conflict rather than harmony. If you want to understand the nature of the Confucian religious experience, go sing in a large chorus or dance in a very elaborate ritual like an elegant French or English royal ball where everyone wants to wear all those ceremonial costumes and dance those careful steps. Most Americans feel more comfortable when we put on old, shabby clothes and plop on the couch and swig a beer. But in this dance, everyone feels comfortable in moving in just the right way. There's no one master of the dance. The dance itself is the master, so no one feels oppressed. The subordination of the individual to the group that's so famous in Confucianism is really the subordination of the dancer to the dance. And that's the thing that causes the maximum happiness to each dancer. A kind of deep, quiet smile and a feeling of peace. More than a feeling, there's an assurance that this is true. This is the way life should go. That everything is in its proper place and the dancers are creating the most beautiful work of art that can be produced in this world. Not the harmony of notes, of sound, or dots of color, but of human beings. You are part of a very large family, and you know it, and it is exactly where you belong and where you want to be, your home. If Confucianism is like a classical fugue, Taoism is like a romantic lyric. Lao Tzu, its founder, turned away from the artifice of Confucian teachings and rules and turned away from complexity and cities and civilization. Literally, he rode out of China on a water buffalo. But before the gatekeeper at the Great Wall would let him through, he demanded that Lao Tzu share his wisdom with the world. So he wrote 81 short poems as his exit pass and rode off into the wilderness, never to be seen again. These 81 poems are the Tao Te Ching, the second most widely read and translated book in the world, next to the Bible. The essential religious experience for Lao Tzu is also harmony, but harmony with nature, or with the invisible way or Tao of nature, which is indefinable but has a definite personality. Water is Lao Tzu's favorite visible image for it. Life-giving, humble, seeking the lowest places, nourishing, not competing, yielding, flexible, formless. For me, the best way to understand the Taoist religious experience is surfing. A soul surfer, not a competitive surfer. All of nature is like the sea, and human wisdom consists in riding the waves, learning to conform to the sea, not to conquer it, to go with the flow, but not of society, as in Confucianism, but of nature. And that weakness makes us strong and happy. Why? Think about this puzzle for a moment. Why is everybody happy when they go to the sea or the mountains or the desert? Why do we love trees more than buildings? Trees aren't practical. We can't live in them. We live in houses. So why do we love nature if our houses are shelters from nature? We must detect something in nature, some structure, some force, some personality. We can't categorize it. Something that speaks to us there, something that gives of itself, some powerful, quiet, mysterious wisdom. It doesn't just make us happy, it makes us wise. It teaches us a way of life, a spontaneous, non-legalistic morality of selfless love, a natural art, an artless art. We learn to be flowers rather than florists. We learn the wisdom of Alan Watts's cryptic saying, "The universe humans as a rosebush flowers." Lao Tzu's book is called The Tao Te Ching, the classic about the power of the way. The Ching about the Te of the Tao. What is this Te? It's a spiritual power, the quiet power of the saint, the power of the child to tame the wild beast simply by being simple and innocent, like the power of water to nourish all life by falling and giving itself up. Contrast Machiavelli, who wrote, "Armed prophets succeed, unarmed prophets fail." Lao Tzu would say exactly the opposite. He would say not only that those who live by the sword will perish by the sword, but that those who live by Tao will not perish. In fact, they conquer their conquerors. Buddhists know this wisdom too. Buddhists love the Tao Te Ching. There's a Buddhist story about a proud samurai warrior meeting a holy little monk who dared to insult him, so he took out his sword and said, "What wisdom can you teach me before I cut your head off?" The monk said, "I can show you the gates of heaven and the gates of hell, because you are the ugliest and stupidest person in the world." The warrior's face got red with rage. He raised his sword and said, "You have one instant to do it before you die, you fool." The monk said, "I have already shown you the gates of hell." The warrior looked at his own anger and realized the monk's wisdom, so he sheathed his sword. The monk added, "And now I have shown you the gates of heaven." You see, unarmed prophets can conquer armed prophets by Te. Gandhi did it. The The Tao is the way of heaven, the eternal way. It's also the way of earth, the way of time, the way all things emerge, like babies from nature's womb. And it's also the way to live according to this pattern, letting the power of the way flow through you, being its womb. If the experience of Buddha is like waking up, and the experience of Confucianism is like dancing, the experience of Taoism is like pregnancy. When we turn west and begin with Judaism, we find a very different religious experience, the experience of God, who is a person, an I, a transcendent other, who created the universe and gave a moral law, and who interacts with people in history, both individually and collectively. He comes into nature and into the human mind from outside, so to speak, impregnating nature with miracles and the human mind with divine inspiration and prophecies. That's probably why he's always called He in the Jewish scriptures, and why he has priests but no priestesses in Judaism, even though the image of God in humanity is said to be male and female in the Genesis creation account. It's an image, of course, not literal, since God has no body. But it shows that the experience of both God and nature is quite different in Judaism than in Eastern religions. God is experienced as other than nature, and nature is experienced as other than God. Nature is not revered as God's body or God's immediate presence. It is demythologized, secularized. But nature is not turned away from either as maya or deception or illusion or dream or projection of unenlightened human consciousness. Nature is experienced as God's artifact. It's de-divinized, yet it's taken seriously. And that's probably why the Jews and their spiritual descendants can take a scientific attitude towards nature. You don't do science or technology on God's body or on your dreams. It's no accident that science arose in the West, where the Greeks developed the logical methods and the Jews developed the religious attitude towards nature that fosters science. It's real but not divine, so you can be curious about it. It's precious but not sacred. It's a garden to care for but not to worship. And the same is true of history as of nature. In Judaism, history is not fate or karma. It's human choices. The Jews experienced history as well as nature as something demythologized and therefore something to be judged rather than as the unalterable juggernaut that judges. Nations as well as individuals are judged by a higher law, God's law. The state is no more sacrosanct than nature is. Even kings are not gods, they're under God, and they're no higher than slaves in God's eyes. Their belief in this higher law gave the Jews an itch for change and a justification for rebellion. If nature is like a sea and Taoists are surfers, then Jews are shipbuilders, or maybe dike builders. Or if history is a ship, Taoists see themselves as its sails, but Jews as its sailors. Or if God is a person, Taoists see him as a mother and Jews as a father. But the essential Jewish experience with God is one of personal dialogue. The God of the Jews calls himself I Am, and the Jew feels addressed by this I, addressed as God's dialogue partner, or thou. When God named himself to Moses from the burning bush as I Am, the human I, the ego, was displaced, just as the ego is displaced in the Hindu and the Buddhist experience, but here it is displaced into God. The ego is kicked off the throne in all religions, but in Judaism, God comes and sits on it. In fact, it's God that kicks the human ego off, not our own yoga. The religious Jew does not see religion as many human roads up the mountain to God, but as God's one road down the mountain to man. Jewish religious history is experienced first of all as the history of God's search for man, rather than man's search for God. Eastern religious experience is timeless and mystical and individual. Jewish religious experience is historical and public and collective. Jewish history is not a history of religious experiences. It is the primary religious experience. It is a story that's still happening. A good Jewish way to ask the ultimate question of the meaning of life is the way Sam asks it in The Lord of the Rings when he says to Frodo, as the two hobbits creep through Mordor upon their apparently hopeless task, "I wonder what kind of a story we're in." That's why a religious Jew is not defined by creed, but by practice, by observance of the law. It's not essentially a transformation of consciousness, as in Hinduism and Buddhism, but of behavior, of the will's choices and the body's actions, all in response to God's will, in dialogue with God. That's why Jews wear yarmulkes, to express that fundamental religious experience of standing under God, in the presence of God, under the eye of God. This experience of being under the eye doesn't make for comfort. But Judaism doesn't aim at comfort. It aims at discomfort. It comforts the afflicted, but it also afflicts the comfortable, which is why it has changed the world. The single Jew who changed the world the most was Jesus. Jesus never told his followers to convert from Judaism to another religion. Instead, he said, "I came to fulfill the law and the prophets, not to destroy them." So the foundational religious experience for Christians is the Jewish one, because that was Jesus' experience. He claimed to be the Son of God, a claim neither Jews nor Muslims can accept, but his attitude toward the God he called his Father, as revealed in his prayers, was essentially the Jewish one: adoration, love, thanksgiving, praise, and total obedience to his will. He said, "I came not to do my own will, but the will of my Father." He practiced what Muslims call Islam, total surrender to the will of God. What did he claim to add to the Jewish religious experience, that is, to this Jewish relationship with God? In one word, salvation. Salvation from sin and death. The distinctive religious experience for a Christian is the experience of being saved, that is, loved by God and forgiven at an incredible cost. Christians believe that God loved us so much that he became a zygote, an embryo, a fetus, an infant, a boy, a teenager, a man, a crucified man, a corpse, to pay the price for human sin. We're only trying to understand the essential religious experience of the Christian, not the theological explanation, which involves concepts like atonement and incarnation and Trinity. Even theologians admit these concepts are difficult to understand, but everyone can understand the experience of being loved. The basic Christian religious experience is that of being literally loved to death by God. Christians also believe Jesus rose from the dead. That's what they call the good news, the gospel. And the difference that belief makes to their religious experience is that it changes their attitude towards death. It assures them that this Jesus who saves them is alive and present and doing things to them. They don't just imitate Jesus, they say they are members of his body. Like Judaism, Christianity is a very concrete religion. It's not spirituality. Muslims worship the same God as Jews and Christians, and therefore share the same essential religious experience of an attitude of absolute humility, worship, adoration, and obedience to this God. Their word for it, Islam, means not only surrender or submission, but also the peace that ensues from it. Islam is cognate to shalom. The most striking distinctive feature of the Muslim religious experience seems to be absolute awe towards God. And out of this flows the demand to avoid even the remotest approaches to idolatry. And that's why Muslims find the Christian doctrines of the Incarnation and the Trinity not only logically but psychologically unacceptable. It seems obvious to them that calling the man Jesus God is idolatry, and that calling God three persons and not just one is polytheism. The absolute sovereignty and perfection of God leaves no room for mediation, only surrender. For God is God, and there is no God but God, la ilaha illa Allah. The focus of Islam is not on religious experience, but on God. It is not anthropocentric, but totally theocentric. Its essential religious experience leaves no room to talk about religious experience, only about Allah. What we think of God is not the most important thing, but what God thinks of us. Islam is the world's clearest, simplest, sharpest religion. It's like the desert sun, and its brightness makes every border stark and every color close to black or white. A Muslim knows exactly where he stands. The Quran calls it the straight path. The Quran is the clearest book in the world. It is also the most memorized, and the most repeated passage of all, at the very beginning, expresses the essential Muslim experience probably better than any other words can. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, praise be to Allah, Lord of the worlds, the Beneficent, the Merciful, owner of the Day of Judgment. Thee alone we worship, Thee alone we ask for help. Show us the straight path, the path of those whom Thou hast favored, not the path of those who earn Thine anger, nor of those who go astray. When we compare the essential truth claims of the different religions, they seem contradictory. Exclusivism seems correct. But when we compare their religious experiences, pluralism seems correct. For from the viewpoint of any one of these religions, the essential experience of each of the others appears very profound and very precious. All our previous lectures have focused on the first dimension, trying to understand and argue about concepts like God and life after death, and therefore they've all been argumentative, dialogues between yes and no. That was right, I think, because the essential law of thought is the law of non-contradiction, which is an either-or, a yes or no. But religion, every religion, says that religious experience is even more central to religion than concepts or explanations or arguments. And when we look at religious experience, we find both and rather than either-or. The different religions then appear more like colors in a spectrum or children in a family than sides in a war. Can we now connect these two dimensions, the experiential and the logical, by asking logical questions of religious experience? Well, of course we can. We can ask logical questions about anything. One question philosophers ask is, what does it prove? Does religious experience prove anything about religion, in general or in particular? Or if not proof, then what kind of evidence, at least, does religious experience give us for the truth of religion, in general or in particular? If religious experience couldn't possibly happen unless the religion were true, that would be a strong argument for its truth. But another explanation for religious experience can always be given. Yet, to the person that has the experience, rather than the person that studies it, it's always convincing. It's a direct awareness of the thing the believer believes, something more certain than any proof, something more like tasting or seeing. As the line in the psalm says, taste and see that the Lord is good. And I think that's the reason why each religion is so convincing to believers and so unconvincing to unbelievers. Believers are like lovers. Lovers are certain that their love is true and certain that their beloved is beautiful. But outside observers simply can't see it and often pity lovers or maybe envy them. Similarly, to believers, their faith is as certain as the taste of salt. But to the unbeliever, it's a dream. And the one thing they simply cannot understand about believers is their certainty. It seems simply unintelligent, naive, narrow-minded, or even arrogant. But, the believer would say, isn't it arrogant to assume that? Shouldn't you try to listen and empathize and understand? And only after you do can you then argue intelligently, because only then do you know what you're talking about. So I think it was very good that we stopped arguing for a little while. For the philosophy of religion is philosophy, after all, and philosophy is the love of wisdom, and wisdom requires listening. In our first 13 lectures, we tried to look logically at the truth claims of religion. In this last lecture, we stopped arguing and just listened. So my concluding question unites these two approaches by asking the logical question, why is there something to listen to? Why does religion say something to us not just when we're logical and not just when we're religious or pious, but when we're neither, when we're muddle-headed and stupid, and when we're egotistic and impious and angry and proud and cowardly and despairing and just plain dead inside? If you never felt that way, then you're not a human being. You're a cheery bird-like machine like Ned Flanders on The Simpsons. Every religion is like a doctor that makes house calls. They all address us in this state of irreligion and offer some way of salvation from it. Perhaps their offers are ultimately the same. That's inclusivism. Perhaps they're just different. That's pluralism. Perhaps they're partly contradictory. That's exclusivism. But they all come to our door. That simple fact is usually taken for granted, but I suspect it's very significant. What does it signify? That each religion has compassion or care or love. Well, why? Where did this come from? Where did religions come from? We're down, and they offer to bring us up, To do that, you have to be up already. How did they get up there? Let's use the two Buddhist terms of prajna and karuna, wisdom and compassion, because these seem to be strongly present in all the world's religions. Where did they get their wisdom to give us and their compassion and care for us that makes them want to give it? Both wisdom and compassion are not just abstract ideals, they're forces or energies. They come to us, not just from us. They confront us, interrupt us, address us, challenge us, claim to save us. Where do they come from? Well, why couldn't it be simply that extra wisdom and compassion that some special people have, so that religion is just the pouring of extra wine from fuller barrels into emptier barrels? Because that still doesn't account for where these special people got it. And because this wine is poured into humanity as a whole before it can be poured from some humans to others. And because the sum total of this wisdom and compassion and energy and hope does not stay constant. Every time a great new religion is founded, it increases. Let's be scientific about this. Energy doesn't just happen any more than matter does. It needs a cause. And this is true of spiritual energy as well as physical energy. And the first cause, it seems, cannot be humanity because humanity receives it. Humanity is enriched by it. Something more than humanity is needed to change humanity. But this something more than humanity, this is almost exactly the generic concept of God or something like God that we began with when we tried to define religion. So perhaps religious experience is something like an argument for something like God after all. In conclusion, these lectures will have been successful if they have done what? Their purpose was not to refute religious faith, or to produce it, or to prove it, but to raise the question in your mind, to get the gray matter moving and alive, and to help you see its meaning and importance, and to give you some tools and examples and data and arguments to test yourself, and to give a sample of how philosophers of religion have used these tools. One last word. I may have said some unfair things. In fact, I probably have. Some inaccuracies, some omissions, some sides of some dispute not well enough argued. I may well have misunderstood a religion that I do not believe. I am not a fundamentalist or a modernist or a Jew or a Muslim or a Hindu or a Buddhist or a Taoist or a Confucian, so I may well have misunderstood these religions. If you think so, please tell me, write to me, we can talk about it. I will answer you. That's what philosophy is supposed to be, according to Socrates, dialogue in the pursuit of truth.
Congratulations, you've now completed this course. If you enjoyed this program, Barnes & Noble Audio's Portable Professor Series features many other fascinating courses, spanning the academic curriculum taught by renowned professors. Visit your local Barnes & Noble booksellers or www.bn.com for a complete course listing. This course, produced by John J. Alexander, is copyrighted 2005 by Recorded Books, LLC. The lecture text is copyrighted 2005 by Peter Kraft. The lectures were recorded under the direction of Matthew Kavnar.